Good morning and welcome to Alternative Currents. I'm your host, Bella Johnson. And with us today is Dr. Kenneth Silvestro, who has written a book on sexuality and narcissism, and we'll be talking to him about that. Welcome to the program, Ken.
Thank you, and good morning, Bella.
Good morning. Can you give us a brief overview of the book that you've written on this topic and give us the title?
Certainly, it'd be my pleasure. The title is Narcissism and Sexuality, a Sexual Outlet for a Self-Inflicted Wound. And as I go about describing the book to you this morning, hopefully the idea behind the self-inflicted wound becomes more obvious. An overview of the book has to do with an introduction to what narcissism might be, but in particular with regard to the theme of the book, and that is the sexual expression of narcissism. Narcissism is a very large category that covers an awful lot of ground. And my view is that sexuality is one form of a manifestation of the narcissistic, what I call wound, if you will. And it's only a small piece of the narcissistic personality. But that is the theme of the book. And that's the point and the images I'd like to bring out today as we discuss the book.
Now, can we briefly just run through the myth about narcissists? For people who don't quite get the term narcissism.
Yes, in fact, I will be quoting different pieces from the myth when I bring out examples later as well. But basically, Narcissus was a young man who was able to find himself in different relationships with both males and females as he was growing up. Many of these partners of Narcissus fell in love with him, but Narcissus had a very difficult time returning that love. In fact, he was unable to do that. So he would move from one partner to the other, and as you might imagine, his movement from one partner to another was very destructive to the ones who loved him. But for him, he didn't feel it. He really wasn't connected to them in an emotional way. And the myth goes on in many different ways, in many different avenues, but eventually he is out in the woods hunting animals and so forth, and he's very tired and very thirsty, and he sits down beside a well. He wants to get some water. And it's when he looks into the water and sees his own reflection, it's at that point that he is filled with love. He is filled with the element of relationship which Jungians call eros, and the Greeks called eros. That's much greater than just sexuality. That's a principle of relationship which, of course, embodies sexuality and love. So he sees his own image, and he becomes deeply, deeply enamored, deeply in love with himself. And he tries very hard to reach out and hold and caress and touch the image, but he can't. And eventually, he dies. And then where he actually died, a flower grew, and that was the flower that came to be known as the Narcissus flower. But in any case, the myth is full of the fact that he, number one, can't relate on a deep, genuine level with others, and his sense of love comes from loving himself. And the important point in this myth also is that he sees his reflection. It's the reflection in the water that provides him with, for the first time, his ability to love. And I'll be referring to that reflection many times over because that's so important in the theme of this book and how people, in their sexuality, will actually look for a reflection in the other, in the partner. And when the partner provides that reflection, then they are filled, not with love for the partner, but filled with a sense of love for themselves, just as Narcissus was.
Now, do you feel that that's a real love, a true love, or some kind of false love that they're deriving from that, as with Narcissus? Was that a true kind of divine love that he had for himself, or some kind of illusion?
I don't think it was an illusion. But I do feel it has an element of true love to it, but it really is more in line with a healing love. Most individuals who are, shall we say, afflicted with narcissistic personality or this particular kind of wound that I'm referring to here receive this infliction very early on in their life because they haven't received good enough reflection from their parents. And so when the parent does reflect the child or the infant at a very early age, they are receiving love. They are receiving true love. And in that sense, what they do build up is a sense of true self, a sense of a strong, deep self. It's not an ego identity. It's a spiritual self. It's a self that exists much deeper in the soul, if you will, of the individual. However, when the infant or the child does not receive good enough reflection, then that connection to that deep self and that building up of that deeper spiritual self doesn't occur. It doesn't occur well enough, shall we say. It doesn't develop far enough. And therefore, the individual goes through life looking for and searching for reflection in every way possible. To receive what? To receive what they missed when they were younger. A sense of that true love, a sense of that true bonding to their deep self from the other, in this case from the parent. But it's only transient for this person who is wounded with this infliction. That is, they move from one mirror to the next, seeking that reflection. But it's only a transient, fulfilling feeling. That's why they must move on to the next mirror, next object, or in the case of sexuality, the next sexual experience or the next sexual partner.
Now, is this good enough, something we can define, or is this different from person to person depending on their sensitivity or their orientation in the world?
I don't think it's something that we can define. I think it's very difficult in psychology, I believe anyways, in depth psychology, to define things that cover everybody in a grand scheme of categories or grand scheme of descriptions. I think this is individual and unique to each person, but using the term or the phrase good enough covers a lot of ground, and that tries to capture the fact that the good enough parenting or the good enough reflection that a child or infant receives will be defined by the relationship between the child and the parent and by the individual infant or child's psyche itself. Whatever is good enough for that individual psyche hopefully will occur. And if it doesn't, then some damage or wounding or some infliction of some sort will occur. In this case, it's the narcissistic wound that does occur in the instance that I'm describing.
Okay, before we go too much further, I'd like you to just fill in for the listeners a little bit of your background and what led you to writing this book.
Oh, sure, thank you. I'd like to do that. My background has been in the field of depth psychology, and in particular, Jungian psychology. I began investigating and researching Jungian psychology. Carl Jung was the Swiss psychiatrist who formed this orientation of psychoanalysis many years ago, and I began investigating his psychology, I'd say, in the early 80s. And very early on, for me, I seemed to find something at that time that struck deep within my soul, if you will, it resonated quite deeply, with some kind of meaning that I hadn't discovered or encountered in any other way before. And so I decided that I did want to go on to train in the area of Jungian psychology, that is, as a Jungian analyst. And for the past 8 years, I've been doing that. The book comes about from the work that I've done with clients and from the material that I've researched over the years regarding not only Jungian psychology in general, but narcissism and the development of the human psyche.
So is this narcissistic personality within everyone, do you feel, to some degree?
Indeed I do. I feel that narcissism is an innate trait that we all carry, that we all have, that we all express on a daily basis. It only becomes problematic based on the degree of narcissism that we live out, and that is that we live out unconsciously. For example, I look at the biblical expression of people being made in the image of God in terms of narcissism, and many other ways too. But in terms of narcissism, I see it as an expression as God having a narcissistic trait in order to receive reflection of him or herself. The need to have human beings created and bring that reflection, because human beings are created in the image of God, bring that reflection back to God, to me that's an expression of a narcissistic trait. Now, if indeed we look at it that way, that is a symbolic view. If we look at it that way, and if we consider God to be that which is greater than ourselves but also part of ourselves, then indeed narcissism is a trait within all of us.
Well, it's kind of like man making God in his own image, right?
Yes.
So how prevalent is the wound of narcissism in human beings?
The wound is a fairly prevalent wound, but here again I'm just trying to focus on this aspect of the sexual acting out or the sexual living out of the wound. I believe that it's quite prevalent in many people in our culture today. I could give a couple of examples from people that I've worked with in the past, again, with regard to the sexual expression. There was one person that talked to me about the need to massage his partner for a very, very, very long time, a couple, 2-3 hours, before they actually engaged in some sexual intercourse. And in the process of doing this massage for his partner, which sounds like a beautiful and wonderful thing in many ways, when his partner was able and did return these words and gestures of gratitude and appreciation, which filled this person in such a way that it was clear that it was touching and filling a wound, and the wound was this narcissistic wound. In this way, the partner was acting as a mirror or a source of reflection for this individual's massage practice. And in doing this massage, he would have to do this every time he was about to make love to his partner to fulfill, if you will, a sense of self within himself that he had been disconnected from at an earlier age. In another example, there was a person who was in relationship with someone for about 4 or 5 years, and at that point, she decided the relationship had to come to an end, and she left the man, and he became literally obsessive and compulsive about his loss, and about finding her, and about getting her back into his life, back into a relationship. He could not accept the fact that she was, at that point, either not in love with him any longer, or had decided, for whatever reasons, it was better for her to not be in the relationship. He could not accept that. And for 5 years, he sought her all over the country. She kept moving with this obsessive-compulsive need to retain and regain the reflection that he got from her, to fill that loss. And, of course, that loss is a very important trait of this narcissistic wound, as well as anger and rage and unacceptance and entitlement. These are all characteristics that go along with this wound. So those are two brief examples. But whenever people are, again, with regard to sexuality, whenever people are engaged in a sexual expression with their partner and they receive gestures and sounds and words and so forth from their partner, and if this fills them in such a way that they feel complete, that they feel some sense of deeper self that they've not had before, or at least not for a while, then we might start thinking in terms of this being related to the narcissistic wound I'm describing.
I'd like to remind you that you're listening to Alternative Currents. I'm Bella Johnson, your host. This is WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 in Bangor. We're speaking a long distance with Dr. Kenneth Silvestro at his home in Montana about sexuality and narcissism. And now we'll continue with our program. Do you think the obsessive kind of behavior targeted on one specific person could relate directly back to mother or father? Is that why this person does not feel that they can kind of spread their love out to other people?
I think that's a fair assessment. I think that's a fair assessment. In the case that an individual may, in fact, as they say in common psychology these days, marry the mother or marry the father, or be in relationship with the mother or the father. In other words, they project their needs and their inner father and inner mother onto their partner. In that sense, I think that your question would be on target. But in a greater sense, the obsession and the compulsiveness that I've described and that we're talking about comes from the fact that once the individual who carries this wound gets a reflection that is good enough, that allows them to connect to that deeper self and fills them with that sense of connection, because the reflection is good enough, they'd never want to let it go. The partner is an object. It is like a mirror. And that's the way they refer to it in many cases. My partner is mirroring me, or my partner. They almost talk about their partner in terms of objects. And that's how it's experienced, even if it's unconscious. And so when they get that good enough mirroring, they don't want to let it go because they get a quick or transient fix to that self, which they have been longing for so long. And you can see here, then, that the true relationship with the partner is missing. That Eros principle is not being fulfilled between the two people. It's really a self-love as Narcissus was filled with when he saw his own reflection.
So do you feel like the partner is being used to fulfill a missing masculine or feminine element within the person that's seeking that reflection?
I wouldn't say it necessarily a masculine or feminine element, but I would say that the partner is being used as a mirror to provide a filling of the wound, the narcissistic wound, to somehow fill that wound, which I wouldn't put that in terms of masculine or feminine energies at all. I would just say the wound has to do with the connection or the relationship between the ego identity and the deep self within the individual. That connection just hasn't formed well enough because the good enough reflection at an earlier age didn't occur.
So how does one define a narcissistic need versus a normal desire for that kind of union? How does one decide that that's indeed a narcissistic trait, or how does one define that?
Yeah, that is a very good question, and it's a very difficult one. I think that that comes with a great deal of time, a great deal of self-observation, and a great deal of honesty. As part of this wound, the individual feels very much in touch with self. They do feel that they have a connection to self, but their sense of expression from self often is done with a sentimentality. It's often done with a great longing for love, with a great idealism for love, an idealism for romanticism.
I was going to ask you if romantic love would be thrown in that.
Yes, yes indeed. These are further characteristics of this wound that I'm trying to describe. Sentimentality is a poor replacement for true emotional relationship and connection to another. And when that sentimentality is expressed, and when that idealism for romance and so forth is expressed, one again begins to sense the possibility of this wound being present. But it does take a great deal of time to observe and see if narcissism isn't being expressed in different ways in one's life, and if one isn't expressing it again through their sexual relationships. Then, being very honest about that, or having someone point it out and being able to accept it.
Because romanticism and sentimentality are prized so highly, and especially with women, well, I know this just because I'm a woman, they really desire this. They really want this, even though they have a deep connection with a partner. Unless there is that romanticism and that sentimentality, somehow a lot of women feel like they're missing something.
From what I understand, that is true regarding women. I would hesitate to say that much of our society is based on this wound, because there is a genuineness to love, and there is a genuineness to that love expression that brings one into, if you will, a romantic relationship. And being able to discern between the genuineness and the falseness is the trick, if you will, is the difficulty, is the way to try to discern this wound versus something that's much more authentic. There also carries in this wound a real deep sense of entitlement. The narcissistic personality feels very entitled. He or she is entitled to have such and such in his or her life, entitled to have a particular relationship that they idealize about, entitled to be treated in a certain way. And when this entitlement is aggravated or frustrated, anger, frustration, and great confusion arises. These are other ways to try to discern this genuineness versus this wound. When this wound occurs, instead of having the connection between the ego and the self, the true self, what forms is a connection between the ego and the false self. I feel that there is a different psychic structure that forms that I've called the false self.
And how would you define this false self?
The false self has characteristics of the true self and the ego. But again, the false self expresses itself in many of the traits that I've described already. Sentimentalism, idealism, idealism for romanticism, idealism for other aspects of life where one is entitled to achieve or have the ideal. A false self is centered around the individual and the individual's desires, so that the false self sees the individual and expresses itself to the individual as the center of the universe.
Does that reflect in this person's relationship with the other? In other words, is the other not really considered as valuable or their needs as important as the person with the narcissistic traits?
Absolutely. I mean, that is so fundamental to the wound that we're describing, the narcissistic wound. It's so fundamental because the individual, again, who's wounded this way, does not have a good connection to that Eros principle, and that is the principle of relationship. Therefore, the person will not be able to empathize as well as one would hope when they're in a genuine relationship. Therefore, they can't put the other person in front of themselves. And they can't put the other person's emotion and pain and joy in a place that they can relate to, because their emotion, their pain, their joy, whatever, comes first.
Can you explain the Eros principle, maybe a little bit about that mythology, too?
Can I first give you a further definition of false self? I can give you a further definition of false self from an author that I've read in the past. This author's name is Nathan Schwartzlott, and he wrote a book called Narcissism and Character Transformation.
Can you spell his last name, please?
Yes, Schwartz-Salant.
Thank you.
And in this book, at one point, he's just trying to describe what a narcissistic character might be. And I believe his definition or his description fits what I've been calling a false self. And this is it. I'm quoting him now. It has a strong defensive quality and does not carry the numinosity of the self in Jungian terms. The narcissistic character also does not carry a numinous energy of the archetype. Instead, he or she carries a forced, power-oriented copy. To me, that gives a fairly good description of the false self. It has elements of the true self, and those elements do carry some elements of knowing who one is at a spiritual level, but it falls far short of the true self, and therefore its sense of spirituality or numinosity is quite artificial. Even though the individual will quite adamantly argue that he or she knows what spirituality is within him or herself, that he or she knows himself or herself at a very deep level, they will argue this tooth and nail because they truly feel they have it. Well, what they have more often than not is the false self and not the true self. And that takes a great deal of time to come to recognize, accept, and then try to transform.
And how might one begin to transform?
I believe that transformation comes from this principle we've been discussing briefly here and there, and that is the Eros principle. I believe the transformation occurs on a very deep level when one begins to truly understand what it means to relate to another individual on a genuine, authentic, emotional level. And that is the Eros principle. And to do that requires, it's very hard to say what it requires for each individual, but it requires a great deal of honesty and self-introspective observation when one is with oneself and when one is with other people in a group or in an individual relationship. In order to bring this genuineness into one's psyche and therefore into one's life, one has to truly start to understand, and you mentioned this earlier, I believe, truly start to understand the energies within oneself that have to do with the masculine and the feminine aspects of the psyche. So for a man to truly connect with this Eros principle in a genuine way, he would have to start to relate much more authentically to the feminine energy within himself. And that can be described in many, many different ways. It has been described over time and over cultures in many different ways. But however that may manifest or however that may be for the individual person, in this case the man, would be the important piece. How does he find the feminine energy with himself and how can he truly relate to that? When he does that, that brings him in connection too with the Eros principle or the genuine ability to relate to others. For a woman, the Eros principle, in this case, again, the narcissistic wounding that we're talking about, would be found in her formation or connection or relationship with her masculine energy. I believe it one mirrors the other. So finding out what those traits are for that woman in a genuine way and bringing that into her life and relationship with her deeper self will then bring her in touch more with that Eros principle as well. So Eros is that deep element of relationship that allows us to genuinely connect with another. We feel it on many levels. We experience it with emotion. we resonate with another person, as they say, at a soul level. But that has to be genuine. And for the individuals we're talking about here, they may think it's genuine, but it's not. And you can see when it's not, through the examples that I've given and through the expressions of their narcissism that they're unaware of, but others can see.
So when one begins to face that this may exist within them, wouldn't that bring up all kinds of self-doubt and fear? And how does one begin to deal with some of these self-flagellating concepts that one would feel and perceive upon realizing that one did indeed have this narcissistic quality?
It does bring up a lot of doubt and fear. It does bring up a lot of trepidation and concern for the individual. And for the individual to start to look at this within him or herself, I often suggest two ways of doing this. One, if they are in relationship, then to actually interact with their partner in a very different and honest way, and that is to be able to listen, hear, and receive from their partner what their partner might see with regard to this wound. Relationships are wonderful for not only for the joy and the human connection that brings to each of the individuals, but it's also a wonderful area, if you will, or place for individual growth as well. So within relationship, if one can begin to ask the partner for a genuine, honest assessment and emotional reaction to this wound, and then the individual hopefully is open and accepting to take this assessment and do some self-reflection with it. And the other way that I often will suggest people start to look at this situation within their self is by not being in relationship at all and spending a lot of time with themselves, avoiding relationship or avoiding even sexual encounters, because it's through the sexual encounters and through the relationship that they most often act out the wound. So when they stay within themselves and abstain from these encounters and from the relationship, then they have to start to feel what comes from the lack of reflection. They have to start to feel the wound in a very genuine way if they can stay with it, rather than having the reflection from the sexuality or from the relationship fill the wound in a very transient way, like a drug fix. If they avoid that and they sit with their wound and in the pain and the emotion that comes up, then there's also the opportunity to heal this wound, this narcissistic expression that we're talking about.
Now, does your book suggest any kinds of techniques or ways of helping one move into a healing place with this?
Well, what my book does in the second part of the book, it goes through a case presentation of one individual who had this wound and underwent several years of analysis to come to terms with this wound and try to turn it around and move into a more genuine connection with Eros and a more genuine connection to the self. And so the second part of the book is this description of 3 years of this analysis for this individual. So in there, it doesn't necessarily give you everyday kinds of techniques or suggestions in which one can follow. It just gives you a description of the overall process that was involved in this individual's analytical work.
We hear so much in the news these days, although thankfully it's calmed down a little bit, about Bill Clinton and his sexual exploits. It brings to mind the question about the person who constantly moves from one sexual relationship to another, to another, to another, and again, not directly talking about Bill Clinton, but just because this has been brought to our attention through the media. Is a person like this narcissistic, and what kind of narcissist is this person? Because the one you have described is one who stays with the same partner and keeps making these kinds of demands upon this one person. What about the cruiser? What about the person who goes from one kind of meaningless relationship to another?
Well, if my description so far has leaned towards the person who stays with one partner, I need to balance that out, because that is not generally the case. Generally, the case is that the individual with this wound will move from one partner to another. That is more often the case than not, because once the reflective mirror, that is the partner, becomes dried up, insufficient, or doesn't provide the mirroring as person desires, then that person turns to the next encounter. And many times, of course, they just turn to different encounters simply because they're there, because they can get a transient connection to self within themselves by the reflection that comes from the sexuality, from anybody, because the anybody is just an object. And they're not feeling like they're using the person. They're not feeling like there is a person there. They're just simply, if you will, metaphorically, seeing themselves through the person. And so it doesn't matter if they're with one person tonight and a different person tomorrow and a third person the third day. And that is, in fact, more how this wound is expressed. It is a transient movement from one person to another, from one object to another, or one mirror to another, as one might visualize it. And with regard to President Clinton, certainly that behavior that we hear about in the media falls into this description. However, I would hesitate to say that he is a narcissistically wounded individual without knowing him and spending time with him and seeing much more about his personality.
So if a narcissistic person acts as though the partner really was not there, what about the person who is pornographically inclined and one who's inclined to excessive compulsive masturbation?
That covers a lot of ground. And part of that ground can be this narcissistic wounding that we're talking about, because the individual can, in fact, somehow through the fantasy, or if an image is used for the masturbation, for example, a lot of people will use images in magazines or videos or something of that nature. If the image is used, then they are receiving a reflection from the image in order to feel that sense of self within themselves. And, of course, the sexuality is the masturbation or whatever else they're engaging in with regard to themselves. But in that case, of course, the person becomes literally an object, literally a picture, or literally something that is not animate, not human, not alive. And so that sort of expression can, in fact, represent the kind of wound we're talking about. But it also can go into other arenas, which I'm certainly not prepared to go into at this point.
Well, that's okay. But I'm just wondering if that wouldn't in some ways be easier for a narcissist, not dealing with another person at all, not dealing with that dynamic, not dealing with being found out by that other person or demystified by that other person or have their intents discovered.
I think for some people that is easier and even safer, as you're suggesting, by all means. I don't think that you find that is the sole expression, even when it is safer or easier for most of these people who carry this wound. I think it's a small minority who will just stay with the image or the video or the masturbation. I think in general, we find more of these people doing that as well as going out and finding sexual partners to act as their mirrors as well.
So it's a combination of both?
Yes.
Again, I'd like to remind you that you're listening to Kenneth Silvestro. The topic is narcissism and sexuality. This is Bella Johnson. Alternative Currents is the program, and you're listening to WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 in Bangor. And now back to our show.
I have some examples here. Not only from the myth of Narcissus, but some examples from a fairy tale play and some poetry that I'd like to share with the listeners. I'll just begin with reading a part of the Narcissus myth and where he actually fell in love with himself, how this takes place. So this comes from the myth. Narcissus, weary of the hunt and sick with heat, fell to the grass, charmed by the bright well and its greenery. He bent to drink to dissipate his thirst. Yet as he drank, another thirst rose up. Enraptured beauty caught his eyes that trapped him. He loved the image that he thought was shadow and looked amazed at what he saw, his face. enchanted by the charms which were his own, himself the worshipped and the worshipper, he sought himself and was pursued, wooed, fired by his own heat of love. Again, again, he tried to kiss the image in the well. Again, again, his arms embraced the silver, elusive waters where his image shone, and he burned for it while the gliding error betrayed his eyes. Here we see the description of him first touching that love of self and therefore connecting to self and wanting to hold that and hold on to that because it's been missing for so long, and that's an expression of the wound. And in addition, we see where he is expressing this burning desire within himself to hold and find that image again and again, to get that reflection. And that is the expression of the wounded individual who goes out and sexually gets involved with one person after the other, trying very hard to regain that burning sensation that helps him or her connect to that self.
Do you believe that narcissism in and of itself is a path to self-discovery that's a positive thing, and somehow when a person carries it a little bit too far, then it becomes a damaging thing?
Narcissism does have a positive value, beginning with the infant or the child. That reflection that comes from the parent and the infant or the child receiving that reflection is part of this narcissistic development that helps the child form, again, this deeper self. But in a greater part, what it helps the child form is a relationship between the sense of I, or ego, and the deeper self, and that deeper self has more of a spiritual element to it. There's a value there. When that good enough reflection is not present at that time, as I suggested, this wound develops, and part of the wound are many of the characteristics I've mentioned already, but also low self-esteem, lack of confidence. And so as the adult moves into life, one of the values of the narcissistic expression for the adult is to get a sense, even though it's very transient, a sense of self-esteem. It can build up, at least temporarily, some sense of regard for oneself. It's certainly not long-lasting, as I suggest, and it's not authentic enough because of the fact that the wound is present. But, for example, I've worked with people in the past who were substance abusers, and many times substance abusers have a low self-esteem. And some of these individuals, once they've gotten to the point where they can abstain and keep themselves free of the substance, then some of these people will turn into the expression of this narcissism, not in a conscious way, but in an unconscious way. And what that does is that begins to inflate their lack of self-esteem and therefore inflate it to a point where they start to sense and feel a sense of self-esteem, something which they missed when they were younger. And in that sense, it compensates for the wound and starts to heal the individual. Of course, then they carry that out too far, and then everything we've been talking about with regard to these traits that are destructive to other people as well as themselves then will continue.
So is this a way of kind of healing the inner child, bringing that child into adult time and helping to heal its old wounds?
Yes, certainly it's a part of that. The inner child has many different kinds of wounds, and this would be one of them, yes. Here are some other examples of the expression of the wound. In the fairy tale that we're so familiar with, most of us, I believe, are familiar with, and that is the Snow White fairy tale, where Snow White's stepmother is the queen who keeps asking the mirror on the wall for a response. And she asks, for example, looking glass upon the wall, who is the fairest of us all? Here is the queen with her narcissistic wound expressing itself as she looks to the mirror, the object, to get a reflection. And the mirror, or the looking glass, comes back and says, you are the fairest of them all. And there is the reflection. That fills her with a sense of self, just temporarily. As the fairy tale tells us, she must do this frequently throughout the day and from day to day. Then at one point, when she turns to her mirror for a reflection and asks once again, who's the fairest of them all? The mirror comes back and says, queen, you are full fair. 'Tis true, but Snow White fairer is than you. And at that point, she does not get the good enough reflection that she is so used to. And she, at that point, becomes rageful. And at that point, she vows to kill, to destroy Snow White. so that she, in fact, can become the fairest of them all. So here is an example of the mirroring, example of filling the wound temporarily, of getting a sense of self temporarily, and then when not receiving the reflection that one desires, the anger and the rage that lives within that wound coming up and wanting to destroy those others around us or whatever might be in the way.
Well, something also arises in my mind when we're hearing this little story, and that's that I wonder if this is tied to a period in life that we all experience, usually after our 40s, when we no longer are the beautiful Snow White, when we're looking at parts of ourselves and having to rely on parts of ourselves that are more internal rather than external.
That's a very good point. That certainly happens to all of us, I think, at midlife, or at least to many of us, and we have to come to grips with that. And that may be part of a narcissistic expression, too, not particularly the kind of narcissistic expression I'm dealing with in this book, but I think it's a very good point you bring up. Now from the Don Juan tales. Don Juan is a very good example of this wound that I'm trying to describe, this narcissistic expression through sexuality. And I'll quote him a couple of times to show, hopefully, how clearly this expression is being depicted. Let me begin with this quote. Don Juan, being well known for his escapades with different women, has this insatiable desire to seduce any and all women of his choosing. And thereby, he's expressing this entitlement that is a companion characteristic of this wound that I'm describing. And in one instance, he sets his sights on this woman by the name of Angelica, who happens to be the daughter of a commander. And he tells his companion, Gonorel, he says the following, "This is going to be one of the most glorious and delightful feats of my whole career." Here he's referring to the conquest of Angelica, or Angelica herself as a feat. And he's reviewing it with his companion, Gonorel, with regard to his whole life, as he calls it a career. So he's not relating it all to the woman as a person. He's looking at the woman as an object to be, if you will, conquered, an object to be met. And as it goes on, we'll see that he is actually looking for the self-reflection that comes from that. So I'll continue. The circumstances that surround his manipulation of Angelica into a reflective posture so that he can receive that reflection are incredible. And what he does is the following. In order to seduce Angelica, he actually seduces Angelica's mother without Angelica's knowledge so that he can get closer to the family, and then he kills her father. And in doing this, he feels as though Angelica's emotion and loss of her father will put her in a very vulnerable position. You see, the point here is that he is manipulating Angelica into, and in a very destructive way, obviously, manipulating her into a position where he can then, if you will, capture her and get the reflection that he desires.
He makes Oedipus look like a baby.
Doesn't he? It's rather amazing. Then moving on to another aspect, Don Juan meets a fisher maiden who he's really caught with, and he really wants to get reflection from her. Another sexual encounter, and she tells him clearly, she says, "My honor means a lot to me, and I'd rather be dead than be dishonored." But those words fall on deaf ears. You know, he doesn't care. Don Juan only has one thing in mind, his self-centeredness, his narcissism, and his need for that reflection. So Don Juan responds, and he says, "Ah, Charlotte, you're not the kind one deceives. Your beauty is your safeguard." Here he's beginning his manipulative moves to bring himself into the encounter, the sexual encounter, so he can receive what he needs. Again, no empathy, no emotional connection to the other, in this case, Charlotte. It's Charlotte's beauty and the attraction that Don Juan has for her that he wants to grab, hold on to, and that beauty brings a reflection back to him, and therefore it acts as a mirror so that he can feel filled, at least temporarily, with that sense of self. He can fill that wound and fill it with that missing piece. Now, when he first sees Charlotte, he's speaking to his friend, again, Gonorel, about another fisher maiden, a different woman. And in that conversation, he happens to say the following, "That heart must not evade me. and I believe I have already softened it to the point where only a few sighs will be necessary. Here he's talking about a different woman, not Charlotte, and he's talking to his companion about this different woman. And in the process, you can see that he's already saying, I've manipulated her enough to get her into a position where I can now move in and get the reflection that I need from her. But as he's doing this, he turns around and he sees Charlotte across the street, and he wants her too. You see how the transient movement from one person to another is really just the movement from one mirror to another, one reflective object to another. And all he wants to do is get filled with the reflection. And his quotes go on to get very descriptive, and maybe I'll just quote one or two more to fill out the picture a little bit. Just as he completes this expression of the need for this other fisher maiden, he does see Charlotte, and he says to his companion again, "Ah, ah, another fisher maid. Where has she come from, Goneril? Have you ever seen anything so charming? Seriously, isn't she at least as beautiful as the other one?" Here again, it's the beauty, and it's the beauty that can bring him the reflection that he's trying to capture and to penetrate and hold on to. Nothing at all related to a genuine relationship with the person. As we can see, he's talking about two women at the same time. And then his entitlement and his narcissistic character is displayed further when he says, "Well, the beauty I wish to speak of is engaged to be married. I caught sight of her a few days ago, the loveliest thing that I has ever looked upon. She was strolling arm in arm with her betrothed. I have never seen a couple so happy and so pleased with themselves. They made no attempt to conceal their feeling for each other, and that moved me deeply indeed. It struck me to the heart. I found it utterly intolerable to see them so happy together. To destroy this union that so offended my sensitive heart seemed a voluptuous duty." He actually considers it a duty to go in and destroy a love, a genuine love relationship, so that he can receive the reflection from this fisher maiden that he has just seen and decides, because he feels entitled, that she should be his. So I hope these quotes begin to give you the feel of how this thing can be expressed and how the wound can be expressed and the entitlement that comes along with that. And I have some quotes also that will capture the idea of the longing, if I can go on with that.
Yes, I just want to briefly ask you if the conquest is a part of the narcissistic personality, if that desire to divide and conquer, like you had mentioned Don Juan wanting to do with this couple.
I think it is. I think in many cases it is. The quote I mentioned from Nathan Schwartz Lahn's book talked about how this narcissistic character is a power-oriented expression, and the conquest is related to power. So indeed, I think it is.
One other question that comes to my mind is the midlife situation again, but from a partner's standpoint of seeing their partner start to decline in looks. Is it possible that that narcissistic quality would stay on hold for all those years, or kind of be covert all those years, and then all of a sudden manifest itself in the midlife crazy husband, for example, only for example, that leaves his wife for a younger, better-looking woman?
Oh, absolutely. That's certainly part of it. There's no question that what you're describing is part of this wound. Also, when I referred to a way of trying to heal this wound by having a man or a woman get in touch with the masculine or feminine energy within their own psyches, when the individual hasn't built a relationship with that masculine and feminine energy within their own psyche, then their genuine relationship with their partners is lacking. It's lacking quite a bit, even though they may not know it. It's an unconscious thing. The partner may know it. But certainly when midlife comes and, as you say, appearances change or whatever changes, and the individual goes seeking another younger partner, it's because of the immaturity of that masculine and feminine aspect within themselves that hasn't developed. It drives them to seek out a younger partner to meet their immaturity.
Right.
To meet that immature part of themselves.
That level of development within
That's
themselves.
Right.
Okay. This is Alternative Currents on WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 in Bangor. You're listening to Dr. Kenneth Silvestro on the subject of narcissism and sexuality. And now back to our program.
I'd like to give you just a few quotes from the poems of Sylvia Plath. Her poems are quite full of many, many different aspects. I'm just going to focus on a few portions of the quotes with regard to the theme that we've been talking about only. I'm not trying to do any assessment or analysis of her work or her as an individual. This first quote from one of her poems has to do with the expression of the longing that the wound carries and the emptiness and so forth. Here's one quote. "To love, to be loved by one, by humanity, I am afraid of love, of sacrifice on the altar." There's a longing that's described in here that one can begin to feel, a longing for love. Now, that love oftentimes is love of self that isn't present because, the individual's connection or relationship with the deep self hasn't formed well enough. And so the longing is often referred to in terms of love for another person, but it's actually a symbolic expression of a love or a connection to the deep self. They only receive that when they connect with another person or other people in a reflective manner. Here's another quote, which has to do with the wound once again, the feelings embodied within this wound. The quote goes on like this. "During that lovely freshman spring when I made him into a golden god, physically, morally, and mentally, naive idealism, although he set the pace for sexual play, I never felt that I was feminine. I felt a seductive woman, feeling physically his equal in size disturbed me. I want to experience my femininity to the utmost. I no longer felt," and this is after some time now, she writes, "I no longer felt the desire flame up in me. I didn't particularly want him to touch me. I don't feel any emotion toward him, no longer the passionate, nervous, tense, sex-motivated hunger that I know was reciprocal. I don't love him, and now I feel a new eagerness at a potential of getting to know a new man." So here, she is giving us two aspects of her relationship with this one individual. The earlier aspect, when she felt he was an ideal, and she made him into an ideal, and the sex play and so forth was ecstatic. And then later in time, when the idealism diminishes, fades away, and she no longer has any interest in him sexually, has any interest in him in any way at all. In fact, she now says, "I don't love him at all, and I now have an interest in somebody new." What I'm trying to capture just from this quote is the transient nature that can take place within the wounded individual. The individual will connect with somebody, feel the reflection, and get a sense of being filled, get a sense of connection to self, as I've said many times, and a sense of that ideal fulfillment. But that can leave so quickly. In fact, it can leave from day to day, and therefore they move to the next person to receive the same thing again. It's a very transient fix. That's all I'm trying to get at there. And I know we don't have much more time, so I won't read other quotes, but the longing is a very, very intense desire that this wounded individual carries, and it's a longing that's expressed for romantic love and love relationships that is highly symbolic of the missing connection to the deep self.
Well, you've given us some wonderful information today, and I thank you. For people who want more information on your book, and I hear you've also been looking for a publisher for this book, where might our listeners get a hold of you?
My address is 938 Hilda Avenue, and that's in Missoula, Montana, 59801.
Can you repeat that and spell the name of
sure.
the street and also of the town? Thank you.
938 Hilda, H-I-L-D-A, Avenue, Missoula, M-I-S-S-O-U-L-A, Montana, 59801.
Thank you so much for being on our program today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to share this with your audience.
Been listening to Alternative Currents with our guest psychotherapist Dr. Kenneth Silvestro at his home in Montana. His book, Narcissism and Sexuality, has been our topic today. I'm your host, Bella Johnson. This has been the sixth month Alternative Currents has been on the airwaves, and it has been my pleasure to bring this program to you, our listeners. If any of you have subjects you feel would fit this program's format, or know of anyone you feel our listeners would be interested in having interviewed on the show, please send a brief description of this prospect and subject matter to Bella Johnson, care of WERU-FM, P.O. Box 170, East Orland, Maine, 04431, or call the station at 469-6600 and leave a message for me. Until next month, enjoy your summer and take care.